What's nice about lensing is that it's a very small amount of technical material, and it's not even that difficult. And then instantly, you suddenly have a very rich world in front of you that has all sorts of interesting applications, and which is surprisingly complicated. And so it all starts with this simple interaction, which is, so you could start with, you have your source out here. So you start with a source, and it emits a photon, and that photon follows a path. And as it's following that path, there's some lump of mass down here, and that lump of mass is going to deflect the path of that thing. And so if you work in a thin lens approximation, you can approximate this as two straight lines. It comes like this. It starts in at some angle, and it emerges at some other angle and comes down here. And this will be true for anything. Anything will do this. So light will do this, as will if I send a box of hammers. So the hammers come this way, and they will also get deflected. And so you can calculate what will happen. And if you use Newtonian theory and you calculate what this deflection angle is, it's just a regular old hyperbolic orbit. And for that hyperbolic orbit, you're going to have some deflection angle is going to be 2gm over the velocity squared times whatever this minimum impact parameter is. And this is just in Newtonian mechanics. And then you say, okay, well, what happens if I crank up this velocity? And as you crank up this velocity, then you start having to take more and more things into account. And if you crank it all the way up to the speed of light, and then you do this in GR instead of in Newtonian gravity, what you find is that this actual deflection angle turns out to be 2 times this Newtonian one. So in GR, it's 4GM over C squared times whatever this impact parameter is. And that's what this bending angle is. And now, this isn't exactly what we need when we're working in astrophysics, because in general, so here's the observer, here's the lens. Well, this would be the exact same bending angle for anything along a line that goes from this point basically all the way back, right? It's coming back in here and it's coming through. So there's some geometry here, but if we actually want to be able to figure out exactly how much things have moved around, what we're going to have to do is do some correction for the fact that what we really care about is that we see some object. So as we see the source, we're going to see the source as coming from somewhere over there, and it actually came from over here. So what we're interested in is the apparent offset of where the source actually is compared to where it started. And so to work your way through that, you have to actually do just a little bit of geometry. And so if you want to define your source position as this angle right here, because remember, we're astronomers, all we have are angles. So at least for now, all we have are angles, and we're looking at angular positions on the sky. So here's beta. And this beta is this distance here. It's where it actually started from, divided by the distance from us to there. So that's beta. And if you just want to use some geometry, what you see is that if I want this vector right here, I get this vector by going here and then here. And so how do I do that? Well, that's saying, well, I have to go out along theta, and I'm going to go some distance along this vector. But then I'm going to then have to go some distance back to get to that point. And if you look at the geometry of that, you pick up this factor of this distance right here compared to this total distance. So in fact, it's not the deflection angle, this classic 4GM over C squared times the closest approach that we care about. What we actually care about is that times this extra factor. So we actually care about this factor alpha, which is this ratio of distances. So it's 4GM over C squared epsilon times this ratio of distances, d deflector source divided by d source. And I'm putting these over here just so you can remember what's coming into these, because throughout the rest of this talk, we're going to have these issues of, oh yeah, what are the things that come into this? There's some deflector source distance. There's a source distance. There's a, you know, just so you can occasionally let your mind wander and see what's going back. And so this is all for a point mass. This is imagining, so this deflection right here, this mass, corresponds to putting a single point mass in this lens plane, say right there. I put a point mass right there, and that's what comes out of this. So once I do that, so I then get in general, if I want to do this mapping, I just go, well, so where it came from, so the angle that it came from is wherever I see it at, and then I just have to reverse engineer this thing by that angle right there, and I'll get back to where I was. And now what I have is a very simple equation that the actual source position is wherever I see it as minus this deflection angle. Now, what's tricky is that this is nonlinear because this deflection angle depends on where I see it. So if I see some source over there, I have to figure out where it came from using where it is and what the actual deflection angle is at that spot on the sky. So this is a nonlinear equation that I have to invert. So it's not that that's super hard, it's just it makes it difficult. Now, this was for a point mass. Now imagine that I had a whole bunch of things all on top of each other. So let's say that instead of it being just a point mass, I have some collection of masses in here. Well, under some set of circumstances, they will all add coherently. That if I have a bunch of different masses at a bunch of different, slightly different offsets, I can just add all these things together. Now, obviously, that's not always true, because if I imagine some case where I had some photon on the last stable circular orbit around a black hole, and it was somehow totally bound to that black hole, then the fact that I add another black hole further along the line of sight is not going to change that deflection angle. So in the limit where the deflections are very large, you can't just add all these things together. So in general, if you're not going to do a complete ray trace, generally people will make the Born approximation. And the Born approximation just says you calculate everything along unperturbed paths, and that should all be fine. But if you're willing to do that, then you can just take all of these deflections and you add them all up. And so that's what's being done here, except here we've already defined this thing kappa. And kappa is simply defined as some surface mass density divided by some critical surface mass density. And why did we do that? Well, because you see that this deflection has in it these factors of m and the distances. And these distances are going to be common to everything that's in this plane of mass. And so we don't have to carry those around all the time. We just define this sigma crit to be some numbers, which we don't really care about, c squared over 4 pi g. Good. And some ratio of the source and the distance to the deflector, and this distance in between. So this is sigma crit. And this would be measured in units of grams per cubic centimeter if you're an astronomer, or kilograms per meter squared. But this is a mass surface density. So this thing right here is dimensionless. So this is the dimensionless mass surface density. And when you define your surface mass density this way, you can then write the sum of all your deflections as adding up like this. So all of your deflections are some integral over kappa times this basically 1 over theta squared, or 1 over theta. Now, what's sort of neat about all this is that in many ways, what we're doing is we're basically just doing two-dimensional gravity. So we've basically taken gravity and integrated it all along the line of sight, and then we're just calculating perturbations in a two-dimensional gravitational field. And it goes all the way down that not only is there alpha, we can write that this alpha can be derived as the gradient of some lensing potential. And the gradient of the lensing potential is, again, just this integral over all of your lensing plane of whatever kappa is at every spot weighted by this log. And so to be a professional gravitational lenser, this is all you need to do, is you just need to keep track of all these things. So you write down a mass distribution, you calculate a deflection. Sometimes if you don't want to calculate the deflection, you can instead start with the potential. And that's it. So just to sort of give you a flavor of the, how it works in the easiest cases. So there's sort of two classic easy cases. I'll tell you when we need it. So the simplest one is just for a point mass. You write down this beta is equal to theta minus alpha of theta. And for just a point mass, we can see what that thing is. And if you put a source exactly on center, so for a source here and a lens right here, what you find is that there are multiple paths. And if you solve this lens equation, what you'll find is you'll find that theta E squared, and the reason it's theta E squared is because for a point mass, this deflection has a 1 over offset here. So this is the offset from the lens, and so that's theta. So you have a 1 over theta right there. Your lens equation has a theta minus a 1 over theta. So you set beta equal to 0 to get right on source, and you get theta E squared is just 4gm over C squared. And then there's this ratio of distances, which makes things a little bit tricky. So this is for a point mass. And so sort of amusingly, as if you look at exactly what this thing is, it's saying that your Einstein radius is sort of order of magnitude the geometric mean of your Schwarzschild radius and some characteristic distance associated with your lensing configuration. So these things are all going, you know, imagining that the source is roughly halfway along the line of sight, these things are all going to be the same order of magnitude, and this ratio will turn out to be roughly the distance to the lens. What am I doing? GM, where's... One of these is in the wrong spot. Which one is it? Well, definitely one of the D's is in the wrong spot, but which one? Theta squared is D. Oh, it is?
Yeah, it's just when you
were doing it. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, it has to be dimensionless. But this is R. Oh, yeah, okay, good. It's RS over some distance. That's right. But if you want to think of this as an Einstein distance, so that, you know, this characteristic distance here will be the thing that's the geometric mean of the scale of your system in this distance. So if you want to know roughly how far offset it's going to be, you just get this geometric mean. It's kind of it's a weird thing that you wouldn't have naively thought. So that's for the case of a point mass. Now, in general, it's just exactly the equivalent of 2D gravity. So it has the same property of gravity in that the deflection here only depends on the mass interior to that shell. So it still has that property that Newton's theorem has, that you only care about the mass inside. So in general, you can always write that there's some... I didn't think I was going to need this many boards, but that's okay. So the last thing that we need to remember, and I'm basically going to show you this just so that you realize that this Einstein radius depends a lot on exactly what you're talking about, that you could also write that there's some alpha, which you... So this alpha hat, instead of it being just this thing right here, which is 4gm over c squared xc. So that's still true, but it's also true that alpha is 4gm over c squared. Why can't I remember this? Where that's the mass enclosed inside of there. And so that says that if I have some lensing geometry that looks like that, I can take any circular mass distribution I want and distribute it however I want inside this point, and the deflection stays unchanged. So however I do that cylinder, the deflection will always be the same. And so then I can do things like I can look at other more extended mass distributions. So the classic one that everyone always uses is a singular isothermal sphere. And you might say that sounds like an odd thing to use, because who starts with something that's singular, right? That's what people usually try to avoid. But the reason people use this is because in three dimensions, the singular isothermal sphere has rho proportional to 1 over r squared. And what this gives you is you get a velocity as a function of radius, which is constant. And as you've no doubt been told this week or last week, if you look at nearby galaxies, what you find is that they have reasonably flat rotation curves, which means that the velocity as a function of radius is roughly constant. That's one of the things that we know about dark matter. So this isn't a crazy model for what galaxies look like, whereas we do know that galaxies are not point masses. So therefore, this is a more reasonable approximation of what a galaxy is. So you take the profile, and in general, the profile in projection turns out to be this mass surface density is some number, sigma v squared, and that's just the velocity dispersion of this object over 2g times 1 over this xc. You take this and you then calculate the deflection this way, and you end up with a somewhat surprising result, which is that the deflection angle is 4 pi, so that's not the surprising part, sigma v squared over c squared, so it's nice that you get that ratio to come out. But then it's just the deflector over the distance to the source, which says it's actually constant. So for normal galaxies, if I look at a normal galaxy and I say, what's the deflection at any point in that image? It's roughly constant. And so you then plug that into up here, and if you have some constant for a source that's right on, what that tells you is that this is also what the Einstein radius is. So the Einstein radius for a singular isothermal sphere is just this ratio of distances times this dimensionless ratio of the velocity dispersion in these dimensionless units. So then you say, okay, what are these in real units? Well, a massive galaxy would have a velocity dispersion of 300 kilometers a second. That's a lot. So in units of C, that's 10 to the minus 3. So this number is typically going to be smaller than 10 to the minus 6. So you have something that's 10 to the minus 6. You have this ratio is going to be of order unity, and you're multiplying by 4 pi, which is close enough to 10. So you're talking about things that are of order 10 to the minus 5 for typical galaxies. So 10 to the minus 5 radians is about an arc second. So what we have is we have the typical deflections for galaxies should be on the order of an arc second. So we've already met arc seconds earlier today. So we're already halfway to understanding one of the things I'm about to say. Okay, so that's all you need to know. And actually, all of the rest of astrophysics using this hammer is just various ways of applying either the brute force ray trace of the full alpha or using models like this. Yep?
With this mass distribution, the sort of total mass enclosed is not, well, for a finite distance it is, but the total mass is not finite. Is
that no, it's horribly divergent.
Right, so would it cause a problem to this?
It doesn't cause a problem for this particular application. But what it means is that all you can ever talk about is the mass inside the Einstein radius. So in general, the fact that it's diverging along the line of sight is not a problem. But the problem is that as you integrate further and further out, it just blows up. So what it means is that when you're using a model like this for as your lensing model, all you can meaningfully say is how much mass there is inside the Einstein radius. And there's some geometric factor to convert that from 3D to 2D, but it's not a divergent geometric factor. It's, you know, three halves or some number like that. So that's not a problem. However, since it just grows forever as R, it means that the only way you can talk about the total mass of anything you're looking at is if you have some guess for what it looks like further out. And a problem that people will inevitably run into in gravitational lensing is that because we're only looking, these Einstein radii are around an arc second, whereas the extended dark matter halo, we think, probably goes out at least 10 times past that. So in general, in most cases of strong lensing like this, you're not actually studying the total mass distribution. You're really just studying the bit in the inner core. All right, so there's all sorts of stunning examples of how this works. So this is one of the first ones that was discovered. And so this crap in here is actually just the source galaxy. But what you see are four almost perfect images of a background quasar. And so this is an Einstein cross, and this was one of the first lenses ever discovered. And, you know, it's amazing. And so in this particular case, you get one, two, three, four images in this very symmetric pattern. And what's happened is that you're not getting quite this perfect Einstein ring because there's some asymmetry in the gravitational potential, which is breaking. And so because of that, you get four discrete images instead of one big ring. Now, there have been a host of lenses discovered. So I think now it's probably, I don't think it's in the thousands yet, but it's definitely in the hundreds, how many strong gravitational lenses are known. And we see them in all sorts of wavelengths. We see them in the radio. So I think this one was discovered in the radio, in the millimeter. And so one of my recent PhD students was Yasir Hezaveh. He did a lot of work of discovering these things in the millimeter, in the submillimeter, and in the optical. And so they're all... How do you know that it's not just four things like this? So that's, in fact, one of the most difficult problems in trying to reconstruct the source, is that in general, if you don't know exactly what the intervening potential is, which you don't, all you have is an image of it, and look, you see some crap there, it could be anything. It could be even, you know, this crap could be in the background. And if you just say, let's do a chi-squared fit for the most likely source configuration, you will in fact find that, yeah, of course, what the source looks like are four discrete blobs with no lens in the way. Like, how could you do better than that? You could have a chi-squared of zero with that model. And so if you allow a completely arbitrary possible source, you can get anything. And so then you have to then dial things back and say, okay, well, so what are the odds that I'm going to see four sources that all have exactly the same spectrum, that have all the same redshift, that have all the same morphology after I crank it through what I expect this lens model to actually look like? And so then you just sort of apply, you know, it's Bayesian priors at that point. It's really just what is your stomach for how implausible something is? And so what you find is that, you know, that in general, if these things have all the same spectrum, and if they match the lensing morphology, then you assume that that is indeed what's going on. But in the back of your mind, there's always this question, like, what if it's not lensing? So my student Yasir, we found a bunch of these in the millimeter. There were, in fact, a couple where you would see multiple images, and there was no model for gravitational lensing that could possibly match the morphology in any useful way. And at that point, you just kind of have to look at it and say, well, like, maybe it's not lensed. But it's good that you can do that. Like, if you never found that, then you would start to think that maybe you're just seeing lenses everywhere.
If we take the set of all these lenses that were discovered, are they consistent with the roughly regular spherical distribution of matter that we imagine for dark matter for galaxies, or any of them very asymmetrical?
Well, so it's a little tricky because in many of these cases, you can't tell for any one case, but for many of these cases, the asymmetry in the potential isn't because the mass itself is lumpy, it's because there's another mass somewhere over here. So you could have a nearly spherical lens right here, but you might have some small companion that's just sitting up here that you can't see very well. And I guess in this case, it would be up here or over here. So you would have some mass on one side of it that is just putting some shear across the system. And that's enough to break the symmetry and take that Einstein ring and break it up into smaller clumps. So here's one in the optical. So this is discovered with Sloan, no doubt. This was probably the SLAC survey. And in this case, you see this the lens galaxy right here, and then you see a nearly complete ring going around. And why is it that we see a ring going around in this case, and we didn't see a ring in this case? Well, in this case, what's going on is the source is actually, the source itself is a galaxy. So for this case right here, the source was a quasar, which is effectively a point mass. That the smear you see here is just because that stupid Hubble Space Telescope doesn't have enough angular resolution to see this thing at the 10 microarc second level that it actually is. In this case, the actual source is another galaxy, and it probably has some characteristic size that's more like this. And in that case, what's going to happen is that there's always going to be some piece of that galaxy that's falling in some spot that can get mapped into this Einstein ring. And so you see there's these still clumps. You see clump, 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 and that's a classic quad lens system. But then you see little bits of the galaxy are spilling over into the Einstein ring all over the place. But so you see all sorts of these things. Now, here you see the problem that I was alluding to, which is lensing is just sensitive to the total mass that's inside here. But just from looking at this image, you can see that there's a whole lot of stars in there. And stars are great. I'm glad we live next to one. But if you want to study dark matter, stars are not dark matter. And in general, they behave quite differently from dark matter. They have interactions. They live and they die. They spew out gas. So in general, baryonic physics is much more complicated by assumption than dark matter physics is. And so if half the mass in here is coming from these stars and half is from the dark matter, then you're a little bit limited in how much you're going to learn about the global dark matter properties of this object if half of it is coming from these stars you don't understand as well as you'd like to. However, there's still lots you can learn. And in fact, I'm giving a technical talk tomorrow where I'll be talking about things you can do with stuff like this. So here's one, here's a version in the millimeter. So I was just trolling the Wikipedia and I stumbled across this one. And so this is using ALMA data, which is the latest and greatest millimeter interferometer. And so here you see HST images, Hubble images with millimeter wave emission on top. And again, you see that the strong lens is just, you know, annoyingly on top of where there's still flux coming from the galaxy. So it's a mix of baryons and dark matter that you'll be probing in this particular one. Okay, now what we have here is strong lensing in a galaxy cluster. And so in a galaxy cluster, this velocity dispersion, instead of being 300 kilometers a second, is more like 1500 kilometers a second. So that gives you a factor of 5 in the velocity dispersion, which gets you a factor of 25 in the Einstein radius. So with a 25 times bigger Einstein radius, instead of it being of order arc second, it becomes order arc minute. And what you see is here is a cluster of galaxies. And so all this yellow stuff you see are cluster members. And lo and behold, what you see up here is you see an arc coming up here. And that's where the Einstein radius is for this object. Now, what's interesting about objects like this is that you see an arc up here that's some distance away, but you also see things like this. There's some arcs here and some arcs here. You're actually seeing arcy things at a range of distances. They're not all at exactly the same distance. And you can say, well, that's funny, because didn't we just show that there's some Einstein radius that depends on the distances? And then but what happens is that not all of these are the same source. They're not all at the same redshift. And so what you have is you have some object that is at the same distance to the deflector, but you have background objects that are all at different source distances and also different deflector source distances, which means your Einstein radius is different depending on where it is along the line of sight. So you now have something where even if you don't know all that much about exactly the details of this mass distribution, you can do relative tomography where you can be comparing Einstein radii of things at different distances. So if you get redshifts for all of these various lens sources, you can use those to get relative distances. So you may not know the details of what this mass distribution is, but you know that it's the same mass distribution for everything in there. And so armed with that knowledge, you can then start using these objects to map out distances versus redshifts, which is a way to learn about things like dark energy. Yeah. Now, something that's a little bit funny about this is you also get time delays. So why do you get time delays? Well, I mean, you're traveling along different sources. So what do we have? We have a source, and we have an observer, and we have lines of that are coming through. And for one, these path lengths are not the same. So just geometrically, these paths can have different lengths. So in the case of a perfect Einstein ring, they have exactly the same path length. But as soon as it's slightly off center, you no longer have that constraint, and the things going on either side will follow different distances. So that gives you a different arrival time. So given that it's going to be emitting at the same time, you're gonna then receive those at different times. And you also get an extra time delay when you propagate through a potential. So that's a GR effect. When you go through a gravitational potential, you add some time. And so in general, there's two pieces to this time delay. There's this geometric one, which is just saying, this is just the basically saying, that's the Pythagorean theorem effectively, and then you're doing the differential version of it. And then this is the thing right here, which is this projected potential that you're propagating through. So this adds some time delay. So this gives you this entirely orthogonal way of thinking about gravitational lensing, which for me is actually, so I like this sort of geometric optics version where we're just kind of doing these deflections, but for understanding these Einstein rings and how things are overflowing, I like thinking about things in terms of Fermat's principle. So if you've taken optics, at some point you were told that you get images forming at stationary points of the arrival time surface, or some version of that, something like that. It says that, so if this was some lens that you had, and these were contours of constant arrival times, you would get an image forming right here because that's a stationary point. And so now we're going to use this as our arrival time distribution. And so this is an unlensed source. And you see an unlensed source where you see it because that's the quickest way to see that light. But now what happens in each one of these panels is what's happening is right at this spot right here, a mass is getting added. There's a little bit of mass getting added. And it's probably a singular isothermal sphere, but I wouldn't bet my life on that without rereading the paper. So some mass has been added right here. And what that mass does is it now adds some extra term to the potential. And so there's now this extra delay that's been added. And the way it gets added is that the it's getting subtracted. And the net effect of this is that that mass is going to basically come up underneath that arrival time surface. So you have, imagine you have this bowl, or you have this, you know, some people are hanging on to some thing that's hanging down, and normally it'd be right there, and then what happens is someone's poking it from underneath with mass. And so you poke it a little bit with mass, and the first thing that happens is the thing just kind of tips over a little. So you first come up underneath, and the arrival time surface just tips over a little, and all that you do is you move this thing over a little bit and you distort it a bit. So the shape of this minimum is now a little bit distorted, and it's been slightly moved away from where you this mass came up and where it initially was. And then you just keep on pushing. And eventually you're gonna push up, and eventually you're gonna have that the pointiness of the stick will be sufficient that it's now going to overwhelm the local slope of that bowl that I'm coming up underneath. And you're now going to see the top of the stick pointing up. So I guess I could even do this. So there it is. Ugh, it's coming up. And so right here, what's happened is the stick came right up underneath, and it's now a local maximum. And so there's now a maximum right here, and there's a minimum that's here, and it's just been moved further over. And what's also happened is because I've created a maximum here and a minimum over here, there's now a saddle point on the back. And according to Fermat's principle, I can now form images at three different spots. So what happened is I went from having one image to now having three. So I always form images in pairs. So new images will always pop in pairs. And then as I keep pushing, I keep pushing and I keep pushing and I keep pushing, eventually what's going to happen is I'm going to create a new minimum on the backside, and that new minimum on the backside will also come with a saddle over here. And again, I will then produce a new pair. So what you would generically expect is that you would either see one image, or three images, or then five images. It should always be odd. Now in practice, what happens is we in fact almost always only see even numbers of images. And the reason for that, that you can see right here, which is what I've done here is I've broadened this one. You see how much broader this is getting over here. Well, what does that mean? It means that imagine you have some slightly extended source, and that extended source will sort of, it'll be extended over this distance right here, and that's how bright you would see it. And then you take that extended source and you shear it a little bit and move it out, and maybe it grows a little bit because this contour is a little bit bigger. Now it's getting a little bigger. So what's happening is this part of the source is getting strongly magnified. This is getting strongly magnified, but look at how tight these contours are. So this central image that appears is always super faint. And so in general, this central image is popping up right where the source where the lens galaxy is, and it's intrinsically the faintest of all of them. So in general, we never see these. And so in principle, they should be there, but in practice, we never see them. But this is what's going on. And so now you can sort of imagine what's going to happen in that case where we had the extended source. So we have this thing right here. And if we now have several sources that are all sort of close to each other, and then I start coming up with a single mass in one spot, if I have some extended source, it's a bunch of these things all next to each other, what's going to happen is I'm going to end up filling in this entire region with images. And if you ignore this H, you see that all of these things are forming at not so different distances. They're all forming sort of close to the Einstein radius. And in fact, what's been drawn in here are what are known as the critical curves, which are the limits of where all the images will appear. So it's kind of it's a nice way to think about gravitational lensing as being, you just have this nice undisturbed distribution, and then your lenses are coming in and they're poking up underneath, and then you just think about where everything forms. Right. Now, where these things form, so this is the time delay surface, right? This is exactly the time delay surface. And so this will be the quickest one. And then what you have is this will be the longest one. And then what you have right here is you'll have points that are in between. And so in general, all of these things correspond to different times of arrival for a fixed emission point. And what that means is if you look at an object like this, so this is the twin quasar, and so it's called the twin because you see one here and one here. So these two things right here are massively brighter than this background, than the lens galaxy itself. So when it was first discovered, all you saw were these two dots, and then when you look deep enough with high enough resolution, you separate them and you see that there's a lens. But in general, these are quasars, and quasars tend to fluctuate because what is a quasar? Well, it's a black hole that's having mass crammed into it, and as the mass is getting crammed in, it doesn't all go in very smoothly, and sometimes you get some backsplatter, and so they fluctuate. And so what's being plotted here are the light curves for this quasar over 250 days or so, and in red is this scale, December 95, 96, January 96. And what you see is it goes up and it comes down and it goes up and it comes down. It flickers around a little bit. And this is in the G band. So that's sort of a bluish astronomy band. Here it is in R band. You see it goes up and it comes down. And then what you see in blue is the other image, except shifted by something like, from December 94 to February 96, so a year and a bit. So with a year and a bit time delay, what you see is exactly that, almost the same behavior. It doesn't quite match there, but you see this peak, it drops, it comes down. You see this thing matches exactly. And so what's happening is you're just seeing a time delayed version. One of these does its flickering, and presumably that's gonna be this one does its flickering. No, I guess it's this one does its flickering, and then this one will flicker a little bit later. And so What can you use that for? Well, you can use that to sort of set a total scale for the problem. You now have the characteristic time scale for your lensing geometry. So you have a time scale and you have angles. And so what people try to do with that is they try to use that to get a length scale out of that, which they can use to measure the Hubble constant. So it, to this point, it hasn't worked super well, but hope springs eternal. So what was discovered recently, so this was super exciting, in 2014, was a supernova Revstal. And so it was named after Shir Revstal, who did a lot of calculations of all the cool things you can do with lensing. And he did these calculations in the 60s. So this is an HST image of a max cluster. So it's a very massive cluster that was discovered due to its copious X-ray emission. And it was being studied because people were looking for, these are all strong lensing arcs. So it's known to be a copious strong lens. And while they were looking at this thing, what they noticed is that if you zoom in on this object right here, they saw four objects, 1, 2, 3, 4. And these four objects all have similar spectra, but not exactly the same. And furthermore, they're time variable. And what this is it this is they caught a supernova getting multiply imaged. So a supernova goes off over time scale of a month or so. And what they caught was a supernova going off, and they saw four copies of it. And the reason they managed to see four copies of it, well, so you can see that they're all at almost exactly the same distance from the center, and that means they're almost exactly right on the Einstein ring. And because they're almost right on the Einstein ring, all these time delays are almost the same. So they saw supernovae here that all have roughly the same time delays to within a month or so, and that's why they managed to see all four. But when you do lens modeling of this, what you find is that there was another image. So the first image to arrive should have arrived about a year ago. No, sorry, 10 years ago. And there should be one more image that's going to come in about a year. So people are still figuring out and digesting exactly what to do with this. It just seems super cool. Like, you have this time variable lensing configuration. There must be something really awesome to do with it. So far, no one's done, there hasn't been the killer app, but we'll see what happens. All right. Now, why were they looking at this object? Well, so one reason they're looking at it was to study all the strong lensing. And in fact, another reason they were looking for it is they were looking for type 1a supernovae to do cosmology with in clusters. But it's also true that you see all these arcs. But imagine, so this is a big arc, which means this galaxy was sheared out almost into a circle. But there must be galaxies out here that aren't sheared out into a circle, they're just distorted. So remember that time delay surface, when I put one mass down, it still moved things out and stretched it a little bit. So a galaxy that's out here, if it's in the background, so this one's probably in the cluster, but this one here is probably in the background. So there's a little smudge right there. It probably actually is intrinsically somewhere in here. And it got moved out, and it should be stretched out a little bit tangentially. And because it's not this spectacular strong lens with many different versions of it, and it's not time variable, people call it weak lensing. And so weak lensing just says you had some image before, and it's getting distorted, which is to say that there's some source position that you're seeing at some observed image position, and that this matrix is not entirely trivial. That the mapping from source position to image position has some things like this, which is to say that you're varying in the x direction, you're varying in the y direction, but you also have this shear, these off-diagonal shears. And in general, that this is it's a non-diagonal matrix, and in general, you're going to do two things to it. And one is that you're going to generically either grow or shrink the image, depending on exactly what the profile of the mass is. And on top of that, you're going to stretch it in the tangential direction. And so you can parameterize this as a distortion matrix. And that distortion matrix has both an overall magnification, and the overall magnification turns out to be proportional to kappa. So 1 over 1 minus kappa, basically. And it's the same kappa as this, is the magnification. And then the shear is just some other gradients of the potential. So you have the shear is sort of the psi 1 minus psi 2, and the other component of the shear is the mixed derivative. So it's the second derivatives of the mapping that you care about. So kappa is the global curvature of this mapping, and then the shear are the off diagonals. So what might you do with this? Well, so it's true that for any individual object, it hasn't been sheared very much. But what's nice about this is there's lots of objects in the universe, and they're all getting sheared a little bit. And they're also all doing a fair bit of shear. So the version of this is that you have some background source that's here, and it's going to propagate through some lumpy universe. This was done by Stefan Colombi. And so it's going to propagate through the universe, and it takes some meandering path. So on average, something propagating through the universe could easily be deflected by up to an arc minute as it propagates through the universe. It's just all of the neighboring bundles will go up and down with it. And then this one meanders through the universe as well. And as it meanders through the universe, these across this photon bundle, the deflection is not completely coherent, which means there'll be some stretching of it, there'll be some shearing of it. And the same thing over here. And so in the end, something that started as having whatever shape it had will now have some slightly different shape to what it started with. And so you could imagine these sources spread through the universe, and wherever they are, you'll get different amounts of deflection. So the simplest, the cartoon version is that in general, whatever you start with, gravity does something to it. It basically takes it like this, and it makes it into something more elliptical. And if this is what the universe was full of, if we had lots of big round red dots all through the universe, this would be a very easy thing to do. And in general, just if you calculate what the mass fluctuations are, you expect just large-scale structure in the universe to be giving you roughly 1% distortions. So this is highly exaggerated. But I'm pretty sure no one would be able to see 1% shear of a circle. And on top of that, galaxies are not round. So here's a selection of galaxies. And just a random selection. And now imagine if I take one of these images and I stretch it by a few percent. How would you figure that out? So if you have any ideas, let me know. Because so far, no one's really figured out a reliable way on an object-by-object basis to figure out how much it's been stretched. Effectively, all you can do is do stuff on the population. That you know that in one area of the sky, it should be the case that the galaxies are quasi-randomly distributed, that you wouldn't expect galaxies right next to each other to be complicated in the same way. And so an object here might have this shape, another one over here has this shape, another one here has this shape, but if I average over 100 galaxies, they should be statistically round. So if I average over 100 galaxies and they're statistically 2% distorted, that tells me there's a 2% distortion in that part of the universe. So just by averaging over many sources, I can beat down this noise and eventually make a map of exactly where all the shear is in the universe. And people have done this. And so this is a recent result from the Dark Energy Survey. And what this is it's a map over something like, so that's 20 degrees, so it's probably 100 square degrees. So they basically did this exercise of averaging over a whole bunch of galaxies at every spot. So at this spot in the sky, they'll average over a bunch of galaxies, and they'll measure all the shear. And then because the shear is just gradients of the potential, you can always invert that and figure out what the exact mass distribution is. You can either plot it as potential, as gradients of the potential, or as second derivatives of the potential. So whatever it is that you measure, you can always go back and forth between those. So they've decided to plot this as kappa, which is the convergence. And what you see is that you see a bunch of blobs. So like all of cosmology, we've measured a random field. And then the question is, what do we do with this thing? And what was neat about what they did is that they then did stuff like this, where they said, wow, what's that big red spot? And they made an optical image, so at the same time, they have optical images, that's what they use, right? They took images of galaxies. And at this big red spot, indeed, what you see is a whole bunch of red dots over there. So this dot here in their kappa map does seem to correspond with some excess of galaxies. Here's another one that has some other excess of galaxies. Here's a dark spot in their map, and there's nothing there. So, you know, it's just this visceral way of seeing that, wow, you really are seeing that where there's mass, there's galaxies. Where there's not, where there are not galaxies, there doesn't seem to be much mass. So we're really learning about the relation between where galaxies are and where the dark matter is. It's kind of neat. Yep.
I would think that it's not a one-to-one. Like if you measured some shearing effect, that wouldn't have a one-to-one correspondence to the particular mass distribution.
It's not one-to-one, yeah, because it's not the exact same weighting along the line of sight.
Right.
That you're measuring the shear distribution of sources that are some background screen. And so you can try to sort of tune things as best you can, but you're always stuck with the idea that when you're measuring shear, it's everything along the line of sight. And so at least if you're in the limit where you only have a single screen, you can't really isolate where it is. And for what they did, it's exactly right. So on the other hand, for what they're doing, all of the galaxies that they were measuring the distortion of had to be galaxies that they could see, which means they're not going to be vast. You know, in general, it should be easier to see stuff in the foreground than the actual objects they were measuring the shapes of, because the stuff ahead, you know, the thing doing the lensing is closer. So it's generally easier to see than the thing getting lensed. So while the weighting is not exactly right, it should be the case that if you have a big giant thing that's causing a lot of shear, and if it's in front of the galaxies that are being sheared, you should be able to see that relatively easily.
Right. I guess I'm...
Now, the amplitudes won't, you know, it could be that there's this dot right here and this dot here, and it may be that one of these looks like it has much more mass than the other, but if one of them is much closer than the other one. So it's this thing where... So here's us, we're looking out, and then there's your source out here, which is getting lensed. And then you have lenses along the line of sight. You could have some cluster here, or you could have some cluster here. So the one that's closer to halfway will be a much more efficient lens. So the relationship between how much shear you get per unit mass is different, depending on where it is along the line of sight.
Right.
But in this particular case, because of the way they did the survey, it should be the case that anywhere where they see a lot of shear, there should be some big chunk of mass that they see in their images.
I guess what I'm asking is, like, so all you're only sensitive in some sense to the integrated effect of your whole lens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So do they have to use any inputs where they look and see, oh, we have a lot of luminous mass here, so we should expect this kind of shearing along this particular lens? Like, map, or can they with shearing data produce some?
So to make this map, all they used was the mean shear from a bunch of background objects, which is, you know, so they have a bunch of things out here, and they said, we're going to define a bunch of stuff out here as our background, and we're just going to make a shear map and turn that into a mass map. And that is some weighted average of all the mass in here. And that's all they did for this map. Now, you're right that in actuality, you can be much more clever than that. So what you can do, it might even be, so what you can do instead is you can say, well, all of these things in my background have different levels of sensitivity to all of my things in my foreground. So if I take an object that's further away, it's going to be easily lensed by everything in here. An object that's right here will barely be lensed by something right here because it's too close.
I see.
And so you can do things like you can break this area up into bins based on how strong the lensing of each, based on how much lensing you see as a function of your source shear. And so that's what goes by the name of lensing tomography. But for this particular sample, they just don't have the statistical weight to do it. So far, the only people that have really been able to do it effectively are people using HST, using Hubble, to really do it effectively.
Sorry, one last thing.
Yep.
What are the axes on this
plot?
What is RA?
RA and DEC is theta and phi.
Oh,
So it's not quite theta. This is longitude and latitude in the equatorial system. So it's just so you can find yourself on the sky. But it's not galactic. So it has almost no value to non-astronomers, like unless you're going to go outside. But we're not going to do that, right? So if you're not going to go out and actually look at the sky, it's a pretty arbitrary set of coordinates.
So when you go to that website and the points of the sky, does it use wavefunction declaration?
It does. But that's fine, because I just want a random piece of sky anyway. So since I don't know anywhere to point, it's all random. So this one is just a plane. So in principle, people can do it in three dimensions. I'll show the only map I've seen of people trying to do it in three dimensions, which is, it's a little sketchy. So I think the people that have the best data right now on this are the CFHT LENS collaboration. So they use the Canada, France, Hawaii Telescope Legacy Survey. And so, they're centered, one is in UBC and the other one is actually in Edinburgh. And what they've measured is the tangential shear. So they basically just measured the RMS shear in as a function of bin size. So shear variance in a top hat window. So the error bars are correlated, so that's why it looks much better than it actually is, but it still looks pretty sweet. So what you see is that the RMS shear as a function of scale is dropping precipitously. And why is this? Well, that's just what we learned, which was that there's more power on small scales than on large scales. So same thing we saw in the galaxy clustering. Remember W of theta, there were many more pairs on small scales than on large scales. There's a lot more shear power on small scales than on large scales for the exact same reason. So this was from 2008, and they've now updated it and put it on a log plot. So you see that, so this is a not, this should be basically zero, and you see that it roughly is zero. And you see that the signal that they're looking for is a whopping signal. So there's a huge amount of signal noise in here. But as people have been pointing out, what would be awesome is to do this in 3D. So why not just divide your sources up into slices? So instead of this dot only being here, imagine having dots all over the place. And then you can actually look at the differential amount of shear in any one patch of sky and use that to back out how much mass there is in each one of these bins. So it's really sort of this matrix operation where you can figure out exactly how much every spot in the sky at every position is getting lensed. And you can do that. When you do that, you have a three-dimensional mapping. So the CFHT lens people did this statistically, but it's too noisy to actually make a nice picture from it. The only people that I know of that have actually made a picture are people using the Hubble Space Telescope, and this is from a few years ago by Massey et al. And they did a 3D reconstruction of all the mass along the line of sight by dividing their sources into different bins and looking at how much different sources were lensed along the line of sight and reconstructing the amount of mass. And what you find is it a jellyfish? I don't know. I don't know what are you supposed to do with that? But it's neat. It's a proof of concept. It's good that people are trying it. And I think most people would say that a lot of the stuff in here is probably noise, but this is the sort of thing that people are working towards, is making these really nice images, making three-dimensional images of the mass distribution entirely from lensing. And then you can take that and you compare that with these 3D catalogs you can generate from these galaxy surveys, and you can really nail down exactly what's going on in the universe. All right. What is the isodensity contour? So these are isodensity contours in 3D. That's a rendering of, they're isodensity contours, and I don't know, it looks like there might only be one isodensity contour in there or something like that. But it's gotta be at the level of a few percent, because that's roughly what the mass, those are a few percent fluctuations in the mass distribution. So what I spend a lot of my time on is actually gravitational lensing of the CMB, which is exactly the same, except that the CMB, instead of being a galaxy at redshift of 1.5, is at a redshift of 1100. And instead of all the galaxies having different redshifts that we have to figure out, we actually know what the redshift is but everything is at that redshift. So we can't do any tomography because everything's only at one redshift. But when you combine that with these other samples, then you can use that as sort of a background screen, and you know that that's behind all the mass that you're looking at. And the other thing is that we know the statistics of the effective ellipticity of our points extremely well. So we can use that to do the same thing of doing mass reconstructions. So the future of this is using these E modes and B modes. And the reason for that is, as I quickly said before, is that if you take one of these E mode patterns and you shear it, so imagine I take this pattern and I pull this side down and I push this side up, but I keep these little headless vectors oriented exactly the same because the gravitational effects don't rotate electromagnetic polarization. But what it does do is it changes the apparent spatial pattern. So if I pull this side down and push that side up, what that does is it takes this gradient and it tips it up a little bit. And if I tip it up a little bit, then suddenly that becomes mainly E mode with a little bit of B mode in it. And so as long as I don't have any of these pesky gravitational waves from inflation around, then that means all the B modes I see, I can attribute to gravitational lensing and then use that to reconstruct all the mass. And on small scales, we don't think there should be any cosmological B modes from inflation. So on small scales, we can use this to reconstruct the mass distribution. And so we've done this with SPT, although mainly with the temperature data. Planck has done it mainly with the temperature data over the whole sky. And what these things are honest to God mass maps of the universe, which is telling you, giving you a map of where all of the mass is in the observable universe, pancake down. So the Planck map is sort of noisy. It's not quite as reliable, but it's everywhere. And so in the SPT map, so what I can tell you is that this is probably like a 7 sigma point or something. So if you go to this spot in the sky, somewhere in the universe along that line of sight, there's a huge lump of mass, or at least it adds up to be a huge lump of mass. And over here, there's a real shortage of mass. These people need mass over here. And so Planck has the same thing. It's a little bit noisier, but at least statistically, you can do the same thing. You pick any spot anywhere on the sky now, and we have an estimate of how much mass there is between us and the edge of the observable universe. It's kind of a neat thing. And so, of course, we're cosmologists, so we take the power spectrum of it. All right, so there's my summary. Gravitational lensing is everywhere. It's a hammer that everybody's using. And you see it in galaxies, you see it in quasars, the CMB is lensed. What I didn't talk about is actually probably the most lucrative way of using gravitational lensing these days is looking at gravitational lensing of stars. And the background object gets lensed by a foreground object, and those foreground objects have planets around them. And what you'll see is that first the lens star does the lensing, and then shortly thereafter, the planet will flip across, and you'll see a secondary spike. And so it turns out to be a way to find planets in a totally different way from the way other people find planets. There's a whole industry of people that are using this to find planets. What I like about it is that you're finding mass, not light. And it means that you don't really care about exactly what the details of star formation or galaxy formation. What you're doing is you're probing both the amplitude of the matter clustering. So you're saying how much mass is there, but also some of this geometry, which says where is it along the line of sight. And so with these things, you're really probing these two aspects of cosmology that all of these other cosmological probes are desperate to learn more about. All right, thanks.